From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Cities all over the country are starting and promoting innovation districts, hot, hip zones designed to draw a new generation of talent and capital into urban areas to incubate business startups and spawn, they hope, economic growth, revitalization, a little bit of Silicon Valley in the city. How's that going? This hour, On Point Innovation Districts, their strategies, their outcomes, and the future of urban economic growth. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Do you work or live in an innovation district? How's it look? And are you plugged into the counterattack on the innovation bandwagon that's blossomed lately? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Seems like everybody has one or wants one lately. Here's a video by Philadelphia's Visitor Center talking about Philadelphia's innovation district, University City, anchored by the University of Pennsylvania, Drexel, University City Science Center, highlighted in the Brookings Institution's report we'll talk about today. Here's one of the local owners, Jose Gases.
Welcome to University City. It's got a unique feel and vibe to it, and it's one of the city's most dynamic and diverse neighborhoods. We're located across the Schuylkill River, just minutes from downtown Philadelphia. University City is the center of innovation, education, science, and medicine.
Old economic centers had railroad tracks. Innovation districts have vibes here right in our backyard. This was January 2009. Massachusetts Governor Deval Patrick touring the Cambridge Innovation Center. Standing beside Tim Rowe, founder and CEO of the center, declared his support for the innovation project.
We can support this kind of economic growth because we believe that innovation is our edge. It's where our future lies on a whole host of levels, certainly economically, and we want to do everything we can to support that kind of imagination, that kind of creativity for the betterment of our economic future.
North, south, east, west, cities are jumping on the innovation district idea. The president talking about innovation in February of 2011, saying this is all American. Here he was at Penn State.
Innovation is what this country is all about. Sparking the imagination and creativity of our people, unleashing new discoveries. That's what America does better than any other country on earth. That's what we do.
So, how's it working? Joining me first today from Washington is Bruce Katz, Vice President of Brookings Institution, founding director of the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, and co-author of the new report, The Rise of Innovation Districts, A New Geography of Innovation in America. Bruce Katz, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
What's happening out there?
I think we're seeing this remarkable model of urban redevelopment picking up pace post-recession. In small geographic areas, usually in city centers, we're seeing an intense concentration and co-location of advanced research institutions, medical campuses, large companies, small firms, entrepreneurs, with housing, retail, amenities, all connected by transit. This is a very, very stark contrast to the science model, actually the Silicon Valley model of the past 50 years, where you had closed corporate campuses far away from city centers, all dependent on auto, each company making their discoveries in secret.
And in a kind of suburban setting, this is much more urban, city center, as you say, much more open. Everybody seems to want this. You start looking at the list. You've got a half dozen that you look at in Seattle and Detroit and St. Louis. We'll hear from St. Louis, Philadelphia and more. But, I mean, you know, Atlanta, Baltimore, Buffalo, Cleveland, Detroit, Houston, Philadelphia, and Brooklyn, Chicago. I mean, you start looking, it's as if everybody wants one. Can every city have one?
Well, it's a remarkable thing in the United States that we have this network of advanced research institutions and medical campuses and large companies with their R&D, research and development, and many of those are already located, were located, in either the downtowns or midtowns of cities. So the first place where innovation districts arise, whether they're in Cambridge, Massachusetts, or frankly in St. Louis or Philadelphia or Cleveland or Detroit, Atlanta, or around these advanced research institutions that are getting large amounts of resources for basic science and applied research, and then commercialized ideas for the market. And because they're located in cities, there's the potential to generate jobs for neighborhood residents or broader residents of the metropolis that, frankly, post-recession still need jobs.
So when I think of an innovation district, I think of, yes, maybe there are institutions around, university or a hospital or a science center of some kind there in the city, but I'm thinking coffee shops. I'm thinking kind of hip, younger, software coders. Capital is flowing through here somehow. Venture capital guys sitting on the edges and looking in to see what's promising. And a whole bunch of startups, if they're lucky, emerging out of there. Is that the right picture?
That's right. And it's really a mashup economy. So what you're seeing, first of all, is this open innovation economy where, again, corporations are not just inventing their discoveries within their own corporate walls.
So this is not Google campus or the Apple campus with security at every doorway.
They're working and they're looking to work with networks of individual researchers and smaller firms. They're opening up innovation. And you're also seeing, and this gets to your portion about or the app economy and the startup economy, what we're seeing really is a convergence economy. Tech is not just something that it happens in Silicon Valley. Technology is now permeating really all sectors of the economy. So there are startups around healthcare, startups around education, startups around government, energy, manufacturing, one of the most technology-intensive sectors of the economy, robotics. So all of this is mashing up and concentrating in relatively small geographies because once you have open innovation, once you have a convergence economy, what do you want? Proximity, density. You want people to basically bump and mingle and share ideas and have that synergistic effect, which frankly is the whole reason for cities in the first place.
So the innovation district, kind of the opposite of the research park out in the suburbs with great big parking lots separating glass and steel buildings. You want the urban grittiness, the cheek by jowl, run into each other at the coffee shop or wherever. That's part of what you see working here.
Absolutely. And the reason why we know this is such a profound trend, actually, is if you go out to Research Triangle Park, miles away from the downtowns of Raleigh-Durham, they are urbanizing their park because they realize to continue to attract innovative firms, talented workers, have this job effect for the broader metropolis, they need to get with the new dynamic. These are pretty profound demographic and market forces that are sweeping the country.
Can this work for everybody, for any city?
I think, and it gets to your point that we're seeing everyone want to be Silicon Valley. Frankly, everyone can't be Silicon Valley. But what we have in the U.S. are very differentiated economies. St. Louis is good at certain things. Detroit is good at others. And so in some respects, regions and cities need to be the best 21st century version of themselves. So as they basically leverage their own innovation hubs, they're beginning to take on very distinctive character. They all don't look the same. The app economy, obviously, is very much of a New York, San Francisco phenomenon. But when you go to other parts of the country, they're really building off of these EDS and MED centers and other distinctive industry clusters that they have.
There's a hot line of critique that's running out there right now. We will hear that as well in this hour, but let's hear from a locality, one of the cities that's diving in on this front. With us right now from St. Louis is Dennis Lauer, president and CEO of St. Louis's Cortex Innovation Community. Dennis Lauer, thanks very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Good to be with you.
Where have you anchored your innovation district? What are you seeing or hoping will come out of it?
Well, Cortex is in Midtown St. Louis, and it's physically proximate to a number of anchor institutions. We have five sponsors. Three of them are academic institutions. Nationally, two of them are national institutions. We have a major healthcare provider, a regional provider, and we have something very unique, the Missouri Botanical Garden, perhaps the leading botanical garden in the United States. So we are right in the center of the Midtown District and leveraging those assets, leveraging the arts district that's adjacent to it, as well as the large Forest Park, which is a park as large as Central Park in New York City.
So you've got Washington University, BJC Healthcare, University of Missouri, St. Louis, St. Louis University, and as you say, Missouri Botanical Garden. And what's the connective tissue, Dennis? What's holding them together or outside their walls, what's happening?
Well, I think all of them recognized that they were exporting technology. There's a lot of world-class research that's going on. The problem historically has been that it's been licensed outside the region to be grown up. And so, quite frankly, the institutions looked at this and said, let's harvest that research. Let's keep it local. Let's use it and turn it for our economic development potential here within the region and regrow the city.
What does that mean materially that you're doing now that you weren't doing? You had all these institutions a decade and decades ago. What's different?
Well, I think they're all on the same page at this point. We've gotten a lot of traction in the last 4 or 5 years, but it's really come from a 15-year effort of these institutions trying to figure out how to work together, how to parlay what they have, how to collaborate. Institutions like corporations oftentimes are silos, and trying to figure out how to work together on common projects for the community benefit has been what the focus of the Cortex Innovation community has been about for the last decade now.
Are you getting the payoff? Startups, growth, jobs?
Yes. Actually, we have repositioned ourselves, and we have a mixed-use master plan. You talked earlier about mashing these things together and creating these collision points. And so we have a mixed-use master plan that projects over 10,000 jobs in the next 15, 20 years. We're at about 3,000 jobs right now. We have about $2 billion of development that is slated to occur. We're at about 25% of that right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about innovation districts, the hot, buzzy idea of hip, high-tech neighborhoods driving urban economic growth across the country, and looking at the uproar right now in some quarters over the whole veneration of innovation. Bruce Katz is with us from Washington, co-author of the report, The Rise of Innovation Districts, A New Geography of Innovation in America. He's founding director of the Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. You can link to his whole report at our website, onpointradio.org. From St. Louis, Dennis Lauer joins us. He's president and CEO of St. Louis Cortex, the innovation community there. And you've heard him describe the dimensions of their ambition. Many cities are jumping in on this front. Bruce Katz, I'm reading here in Tech Magazine, you know, they look out at innovation districts and they say, well, it looks an awful lot like a regular, well-designed city, only with more hype. Is that fair, Bruce, or what?
I don't think that's fair, actually, because the difference with innovation districts when they work is they work for a broad number of people, right? Because if you think about the innovation economy, or what we call the STEM economy, science, technology, engineering, math, 40 to 50% of those jobs can be filled by people with sub-baccalaureate degrees. They either have high school degrees with technical skills or associate degrees from community colleges. So when innovation districts are done right, there's an intentionality about bringing more people, local residents, particularly low and moderate income young adults, into this economy. So I don't think this is your parents' innovation economy, particularly one that was suburban and was closed and was isolated. These are right smack in the cores of cities where you can literally walk to public housing developments or other low and moderate income neighborhoods. If we get this right, this could have an enormous job effect for people who've been really left out of the economy.
Dennis Lauer in St. Louis, is it working for low and moderate income youth when we sort of think of the innovation district profile as pretty well educated, kind of up there on that early earner scale, the coder, the STEM grad? Is that low and moderate income jobs in your city?
Well, it is an entire continuum. And, to be certain, there are systemic urban issues that need to be addressed. And we continue to work in our city with trying to address those issues. But we have very intentional programs, educational programs that reach down to middle school as well as high school. We have mentorship programs. We also have some targeted research initiatives that are engaging our historically black universities that are in planning right now. So you need to be intentional, but there is that entire continuum. So 40 to 50% of the jobs are, high school and baccalaureate, and then the rest go up from there. So there's a lot of breadth. And when you're talking 10 to 15,000 jobs like we are, That's a lot of opportunity that's there, and that's just direct jobs. Then there are also the indirect jobs and multiplier effects that come from that.
Brookings Institute published a video last month talking about innovation districts. They're cool, it says.
Innovation districts are this century's productive geography. They are both competitive places and cool spaces, and they will transform your city and metropolis.
Watch out. They're coming, innovation districts. They'll do it all for you. Katie in Lexington, Virginia. Katie, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you. I was just thinking that this could even have a more creative or innovative aspect if you did things like took libraries, which are dying, and used those spaces, which are generally in centralized areas anyway, and use those spaces because not only would that revitalize libraries, but also environmentally building new structures and all that junk that's created by doing such a thing, you wouldn't have to use as much of that. You would already have a structure that you can add on or, change to meet the needs.
Yeah, Katie, I appreciate your call. I think a lot of people lining up with that kind of thinking. I don't know about taking public buildings, but maybe, Bruce Katz, it's a lot of old warehouses being converted, properties that are underutilized, and suddenly, with luck, they're turned into these buzzy communities of innovators. What about public libraries? I mean, you would be taking something public into a private realm there, Bruce.
I actually think this is a great idea, and there are cities like Chicago that are planning to use some of their public libraries as co-working spaces, because that's how so many people in some portions of the tech economy now work. I mean, they're free agents, they're in startups. They want to be in places where, again, they can bump and mingle with others and have access to shared services, whether it's legal, whether it's accounting, whether it's business management. So I think the public library is a perfect example of an institution that is, in some places, will be reinvented, actually, for this purpose. And as we see in the Boston Seaport, Seattle South Lake Union, Brooklyn Navy Yard, there's whole portions of older industrial areas of the city. And remember, portions of Cambridge were older industrial areas near MIT that are being repurposed for this new innovative use. The fact of the matter is a portion of our population now really demands livability, walkability, bikeability, transit access in the communities where they live. They don't want to be stuck in traffic driving 30, 40, 50 minutes to their office every day and then not having that urban experience as they go about their work.
New generation wants livability. Pam in Nashville, Tennessee, you're on the air, Pam. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I just want to say I'm a university student in the Nashville area, and I faced the idea of leaving college and being swallowed up by corporate America. And I really like the idea of these innovation communities because I think that they're reinventing the economy for people in creative, like, job occupations. And I like the idea of the fact that they're touching areas that haven't really been touched in a while because of the way that America has shifted to this corporate way of thinking. I like the idea of, like, kind of the hip, new, the coffee shops and the entrepreneurship and the small technology businesses and the retailing. And I just think that's great. And it gives a little more of a hope to someone like me who's going into, like, creative writing and research. And I don't really want to work for a corporate company, and I really think these innovation communities are a good thing for young Americans.
You know, it's still private sector. I mean, they will still be corporations, maybe not big ones at the beginning, Pam. Does that make a difference to you?
Yes. I mean, it makes the size of the businesses that I would want to be involved with, it means a lot to me. You know, I mean, working for a company like Apple or Google, I mean, it's a giant corporation. I know that it's still private sector, the innovation communities are, but the fact that it's smaller, I think, makes a big difference to me and a lot of kids my age. You know,
yep.
I mean, we're college age, and I want to go into technology, but I don't want to work for Google, you know?
And it's very much aimed at Americans your age, Pam. I appreciate your call. Pam says, bring it on in Nashville. John in Westboro, Massachusetts. John, thank you for calling. You're on the air. What do you think?
Good to talk to you. And I think you got it just right when you characterized this as buzz and hype.
Well, I mean, I'm asking, what do you think?
Well, I think I think whatever it is, you'd have to watch out for it if you walk through a cow pasture. I think if you look at scientists and real innovators, they don't care about their surroundings. Steve Jobs worked in a garage. Other scientists with whom I've been privileged to work, the Nobel laureates and others, they were obsessed with their new idea. They didn't need a park. They didn't need special offices. But I do think I think this completely misses the point of genuine innovation. And in addition to that, I guarantee you one thing that this kind of thing will produce. It will produce a lot of bureaucracy and developers and executives. And it's not something we should be trapped into. There are better ways to use our resources.
John, let us pick it up. Bruce Katz, you hear our scientists calling in and saying, come on, real scientists don't need all these trappings, urban claptrap. Come on.
I think you just have to look at where companies that really have large amount of research scientists are locating. They need to be the secret sauce of these advanced research institutions and medical campuses and other companies. They need to be near pools of talented workers. They need to be where ideas are being generated and the mashup of ideas. Ideas, you know, when I go to Houston, they talk about how do we mash up ideas coming out of the energy cluster or the Texas Medical Center with our existing space focus. I mean, that's how really interesting innovation happens.
Even Silicon Valley talking now about
being
too far from San Francisco. Dennis Lauer, do you have companies coming into St. Louis Center to try and take advantage of that mashup dynamic?
Yes, it's not just about startup companies, but you know, corporate culture is struggling right now for talent acquisition. And the earlier caller talked about wanting to be in a more urban environment. Millennials want to be in a walkable, public transit-oriented environment with cultural access at will. And those are difficult things when you have to drive 45 minutes, park in a suburban parking lot, and be inside a large building all day. So what we're finding is that a number of large established Fortune 100 companies that are in the region are working with us and talking with us and actually making commitments now to lease space within the district precisely to be able to access that talent, to access the assets and pipeline of the research that's going on, as well as trying to take some of their shelf technologies and bring them into an entrepreneurial environment and be able to expose them to other entrepreneurs in the district and see what do we have here? Do we have a new disruptive technology that we can bring to the marketplace? So it really, as Bruce indicated, it is a mashup, and it's larger cultural forces that are at play here, and it's corporations that are trying to find their way in an increasingly changing environment, technology environment.
Dennis Lauer, please stand by there in St. Louis, head of the Innovation District there, the Cortex Innovation Community. Bruce Katz with Brookings, co-author of The Rise of Innovation Districts, a new geography of innovation in America. Joining me now in the studio is John Summers. He's editor-in-chief of the Baffler Journal, a cultural political magazine headquartered in Cambridge, Massachusetts, innovation territory around the corner here. Had a piece not so long ago headlined, "The People's Republic of Zuckerstan, Not So Enchanted with the Innovation Economy, Innovation Districts." John Summers, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. You point to a relentless torrent of boosterism, quoting you here. What's your problem with the whole narrative?
Well, there's lots of different ways of approaching it, but I was actually pushed back in my chair a bit here by the relentless torrent of boosterism I've been hearing. I mean, I believe that Mr. Katz and the other participants in the conversation believe that in intentionality and in vibrancy and in synergy and bump and mingle and secret sauce. I believe that they believe it because I've read it a million times. I mean, the whole discussion seems to me like we're back in the 90s, actually, which is a minor irony considering the
future-oriented. The internet bubble days, you mean?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, it used to be called the new economy. The Baffler has done a whole anthology on this in 2003 of what we call the mad cultural politics of the new economy movement. And it's pretty much all the same thing. It's not to say that there's nothing there. It's just to say two points quickly. One is that it actually benefits a very small number of people. If you look at the kinds of jobs that actually aren't boring jobs, And the other point is that it kind of depends on a wholesale reengineering of the cultural environment to present what are actually political choices in the universalist rhetoric of the market. So it strikes me that strange that after 2008, when we had this opening to begin to talk seriously about alternative economic developments, 6 years later, we're back to, oh, we need to start another private company to save the country. I mean, it's a little bit tiresome to hear all this. Feels like I want to, you know, go grab my George Orwell off the shelf or something.
Tiresome, but I mean, cities point to these districts and they say, look at all these startups, look at these new jobs, look at these coders coming in and more than coders. They're making new products, they're disrupting and in ways that are going to bring more
That's
economic
good.
Activity yeah. to our neck of the woods.
Mm-hmm. It's a great deal for business. Yeah, you come into an environment and you basically get public resources to pay for all of your research and development costs. And
gets, as in universities or hospitals?
As in, yes, ostensibly nonprofit mm-hmm. universities. Just mm-hmm. a great story about innovation economies in the last 20 years is the way that they've abused the nonprofits to funnel money. I mean, for the investor class looking to park lots of accumulating capital, they're great deals because they're unregulated. The jobs they produce, you've never heard a word about labor unions or union jobs in this conversation. And when you get them, you get construction crews who are building, in Cambridge at least, large office parks and can't afford to live anywhere else because the rents are too high.
It's true. Very big development has come in there. Many places would pray for that. You're looking at a downside to it as well. Johnny in Dothan, Alabama. Johnny, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Well, thank you, Tom, and thank you. It's a very delighted conversation you're having. As the urban planner here in Alabama, we have to be very careful because this is a dicey situation because the devil's in the details. And most of the time when urban planners and city planners get together on such a great venture like this, you're kind of giving the whole city away from, in-kind services such as infrastructure, brownfield money. Most of the time, your low to moderate income sectors lose out. I spoke to you a few months ago. We was talking about baseball and the lack of blacks playing baseball, where it goes back to the same issue. If your urban planners and your city fathers are not putting excess monies in those low-income and moderate areas, and they're going for the gusto trying to get these franchises to come in, most of the time a franchise don't want to go in certain sectors unless they're getting a big chunk of the pie. Now, what's in it for me? Are you going to help me with land? Are you going to help me with turning lanes? Are you going to help me with infrastructure? So you're going to give up a whole lot just to get something. In other words, you're spending a hell of a lot of money to buy jobs, and that's what this is all about.
But do you see a net loss, Johnny? Is it better off if nothing happens there and it rolls along at a low economic level?
Well, you mentioned Chicago earlier. They're in a fix now. With this, everybody's fighting for crumbs. And just picture a house, if you will.
Mm-hmm.
If we try to fix the right side of the house, and we leave the left side of the house unfixed, it becomes put that house in a substandard area. That part of the house is falling apart, but you're so focused on the right part of the house. So as a whole city, the house is going to fall apart eventually because you're only working on one side of the house.
Johnny in Alabama, we got a break right here. I'm going to come back and bring it to our guests. I appreciate your call very much. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about innovation districts, the hot, buzzy idea of hip, high-tech neighborhoods driving urban economic growth across the country, and the uproar right now in some quarters over the whole veneration of innovation itself. We heard President Obama saying earlier, innovation is the very heart and soul of what America does. In January this year, the president spoke in Raleigh, North Carolina, about innovation hubs.
We're going to be launching two more of these innovation hubs. We've already got them all planned up. One's going to focus on digital design and manufacturing. Another is going to be developing lightweight metals that could transform everything from wind turbines to military vehicles. And together, they're going to help build new partnerships in areas that show potential. They'll help to lift up our communities. They'll help spark the technology and research that will create the new industries, the good jobs required for folks to punch their ticket in the middle class.
But there is pushback as well, even in kind of the heart of all this. San Francisco lately has seen all kinds of controversy because of culture clash between the tech folks coming in and others who can't afford to live there anymore, uproar over private buses, Google and Apple taking their employees off to Silicon Valley. Here's a bit of sound from Deepa Varma from a protest in December. She's with Eviction Free SF, talked about the local with the local ABC News channel about her protests.
This bus is a symbol of the housing crisis that's happening right now in San Francisco and how the city is becoming increasingly unaffordable.
We're talking this hour with Bruce Katz, co-author of The Rise of Innovation Districts with the Brookings Metropolitan Policy Program, Dennis Lauer, president and CEO of St. Louis Cortex Innovation Community, and John Summers, editor-in-chief of the Baffler Journal. He's written up a pretty big critique of the whole movement. He says, you're privatizing public goods and more here. John in Cambridge, Massachusetts. John, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me. I live and work in Cambridge in Kendall Square, and I'm in banking and finance. And I two points I just wanted to make. It's innovation districts. I don't think are hype at all. They're here to stay. They're, I think, what's going to fuel the economy. And the second point is I believe that the cluster of innovation districts is what creates ideas. It's not, your previous caller mentioned that it's not necessary to be in an urban center. I think it's ideas gets transferred and innovation gets transferred to the wild most of a lot of times. And when you're in a petri dish of different innovation, it creates even new technologies moving forward. And I believe the jobs that will be created and the change to the demographics of the area will propel cities forward, not backwards.
Hey, John, hang on. I want to put you on the air here with John Summers of the Baffler, who's critical of innovation districts. Stick with us, John, in Cambridge. John Summers, you hear the support here. Our caller, John, is in it. He's of it. He sees a lot of promise in it. He thinks this is what will fuel our economy in this century.
Well, it may fuel the economy of John in Cambridge, or that John in Cambridge at least, but not the other Johns that I know and the other people that I live and work in Cambridge as well. I live in Inman Square, and we have the magazine's headquarters is in Inman Square, just about a mile.
Not an innovation district, though a very lively neighborhood.
God forbid. No, not yet. But one question I have about Kendall Square, since the caller brought it up, is it seems to me that there's not much of any kind of civic culture there. And I haven't seen yet, in spite of the efforts to gin it up in innovation districts, it's always called – and by the way, you always know if you're onto an innovation cliche, if you hear the word vibrancy, okay, because that's key. Everything is vibrant. But if you actually look and see what is meant by vibrancy, it's completely unclear. So I would ask the caller, is it really – does it feel like a civic culture? Does it feel like a culture that can, in Kendall Square, that can support middle-income people as well as wealthy – tech professionals?
Caller John, what do you say? You're in it.
Yeah, I totally believe that. Yes, I mean Kendall Square, you've got to remember, has transformed in the past just 5, 6, 7 years. So it's still somewhat of a younger neighborhood that's coming along. We're not done developing yet. So all these trappings of that you're probably referring to eventually would come along. We all hope that they would.
This is what we keep hearing. Everything is going to – there's a lot of what we heard of as intentionality, which is what is the language of opportunity, which is give us a lot of money and we intend to do what you think we're going to do. But when is exactly that going to come along? When is that going to happen? It seems that the whole structure, whole architecture of Kendall Square, which is full of office parks and zipped up laboratories, actually discourages any kind of pedestrian walks. I mean, of course, there's the coffee shops and the cupcake shops.
Yeah.
Well, basically the same thing. It's the city as a lifestyle accessory. Again, it's back to the 90s.
Yeah.
It's the same everywhere.
Caller John, I really appreciate your call. Bruce Katz, what about it? Will these innovation districts produce the kind of jobs that steel plants and auto plants, the kind of communities that traditional industry produced ultimately, or is John Summers right that it's, it'll be Starbucks and cubicles and good luck if you're not in that set?
I think we have to go back to the work of Enrico Moretti, the great regional economist, who put out a book called The New Geography of Jobs quite recently.
Mm-hmm.
He said for every one tech or innovative job, you're generating 5 jobs. Here's really the major point to this conversation.
Mm-hmm.
We have a jobs deficit in the United States post-recession. We still have to grow 7 million jobs to make up the jobs we lost, keep pace with population growth. And we've seen a growth in poverty and near poverty from 80 million people in 2000 to 107 million in 2011. I think these innovation districts, the manufacturing innovation institutes that the president announced, mm-hmm. I think this is part of a shift in an economy that was based on consumption and debt to one that really is based on innovation and production and basically inventing discoveries both for our market and for markets abroad. That's how you grow jobs. I understand the critique mm-hmm. about from the surface this might only be benefiting a small number of people, but that's not how these innovation economies actually work. By all the evidence that has been collected for quite some period of time.
John Summers, what's your alternative there? The auto plants, many of them are gone. The steel plants, many of them are gone. A lot of traditional economy.
Yes, they've been disrupted, yes.
Well, whatever reason, they're gone. So, you may not like the cut of the jib of this movement, but what's the alternative if you want vibrance?
Vibrancy scares. That kind of scares me.
I mean, real vibrance.
Right. I agree with Mr. Katz that lots of jobs have been lost. But can we talk for just a second about exactly how that happened? Because I thought it was because we deregulated industries who were pushing for what they called a new economy on behalf of innovation, which landed us with a lot of really innovative and interesting financial instruments that wrecked the global economy. So the idea that we
wasn't
it
even earlier
to,
than that. Didn't we lose them to lower wage competitors
we've been
abroad, Japan and China? That's not exactly about innovation. That was just different wage scales, and off they went.
It was a kind of creative destruction. And which has continued to reverberate, which is another one of the cliches that one hears again and again and again. Why do we have to create lots of jobs of any kind in order to get people out of poverty? For example,
I don't understand that question. Without jobs, how do people have an income? How do they create value? And how are they productive in a way that...
There are all kinds of ideas that don't ever come up because of the way that marketing campaigns and branding exercises work like this. Basic income guarantees, for example. We're seeing a minimum wage law that's
But even that has to be based somewhere in productive activity.
Right. Well, it could... Okay. Put it this way. That clip you played of Obama talking about entrepreneurship and innovation hub, can you imagine Franklin Roosevelt saying that in 1935? What Franklin Roosevelt and the Democrats and people who called themselves liberal did in 1935 was they invented something called the Works Progress Administration, which gave grants to artists and writers and musicians and lots of other – and construction workers.
But that was out of desperation, right?
Yeah,
we were in depression. Are we in a comparable place now? Maybe this is an alternative.
Doesn't feel that way. It doesn't feel kind of desperate to the people who are pushing innovation economies. But those aren't the people that I know and that we work with in the magazine. And the whole cultural side of this has really been a sham. I mean, they've basically taken the culture and reformulated culture. Any kind of legitimate culture, or actually it's the cult of what they call creativity, can only be redeemed and is only legitimate as long as it feeds a private product. This is rampant commodification. It doesn't give us the kind of culture that lasts. It gives us the kind of same kind of disposable inventions that you get with tech culture.
Dennis Lauer, how about your experience, your aspiration? Will this work for the whole city of St. Louis? You've got plenty of, like many cities, plenty of poverty there as well. Does it work for the whole culture of St. Louis? Or will it narrow it down to a kind of high-tech utopia that doesn't include a lot of things?
No, I think that innovation districts really begin to democratize the access to jobs and the creation of wealth at much smaller levels. So there's much more opportunity, entrepreneurial opportunity. I mean, the economy is really built on new technology, new innovation, and new innovations are disruptive. They disrupt status quos oftentimes. But they also provide a lot of opportunity. And so what we're trying to do here is to grow, a new batch of companies where the wealth is kept local. In this country, we've seen the migration of wealth out of smaller regional corporations and to roll-ups of large corporations. And I think that innovation districts, through the density with entrepreneurs, with new technologies coming out of not just the universities, but the corporations, really provides much more open access. And it's coming as a public-private partnership. So, you know, we can stand back and we can look at years past and how things were handled 60, 70, 80 years ago. But it doesn't do much now in a global economy where we're trying to pull meager resources together and to be creative about them, because this is, technology is a very creative process that involves a broad spectrum of technologies and the intersection of those technologies. So, you know, what I'm seeing here is an opening of the opportunities for people to access and have an on-ramp where they can create their future. And that, you know, that's pretty exciting to me, and I think it's exciting to St. Louisans. Now, does that mean that there aren't inequities? Of course there are, but the inequities are there before we even brought this focus to the table. We have a new tool, and I don't understand why we would want to diss a new tool that is pretty much open and allows people to access it and touch it from so many different places.
Yep.
We have to reinforce it, reinforce the support that's there.
There's a man who needs it and wants it for St. Louis, Thomas in Rexburg, Idaho. Thanks for calling, Thomas. You're on the air.
I do want to say that this can work. I'm in the middle of a town of about 30,000 people. We have a BYU satellite campus that works with a private venture capitalist company that works with a building complex that rents out low rent business,
space.
Yeah, business space that has shared space, et cetera. And I have seen myself included in this, these college students that will be drawn out of the college to this private sector space, then mingle and grow to the point where, you know, we're seeing these companies that start as $100,000 a year small startups to, I have one that in the course of about 2 years is now grossing about $2 to $3 million. And it's just a matter of brains coming together and having that space. And it does. It works at least at this small level in a town that does have college labor and that, at a population of about 30,000 people.
Hey, Thomas, congratulations on your efforts there. It sounds great. Let me get one more call here, and I'll take it to my guest, Heather, in Bloomingdale, New Jersey. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
So I'm a recent college graduate, and I was living in Jersey City trying to find a job. I'm a designer, and I fall into the category that owes about $100,000 in student debt.
Ouch, yeah.
So I'm looking for a job in the city, and basically it was impossible for me to find rent in Jersey City that I'd be able to pay my student loans with off as well. So I was basically forced out of Jersey City into the suburbs.
How does it tie into innovation districts, Heather? What's the connection you see?
Well, my question is, how is it different than gentrification? Because I feel like in Jersey City, we're getting all these coffee shops and, you know, self-serve froyos that are overly designed. Because of that, I couldn't afford my rent, and I just saw it as gentrification. So I had to move out of that area and settle for a lower salary.
And off you went. Bruce Katz, what about it? Heather asks, how is this different from gentrification? What's in it for her?
Well, look, if innovation districts are going to work for a broad swath of people, particularly in high-rent markets like the New York Metro, the Boston Metro, San Francisco, then we've got to basically have housing policies that both preserve affordable housing and expand the supply of affordable housing at a time when the federal government is really scaling back their support for this. So cities are going to have to get super creative around land use, zoning, taxes, and market mechanisms.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, if we're going to bring more people into this, we're going to have to upgrade education and skills starting, frankly, in K-8. In our high schools with computer science.
I mean, here's Heather. She's invested $100,000 in debt and doesn't feel like she's equipped.
Well, because I do think that many of these smaller municipalities, and Cambridge is a small one, Jersey City is a small one, really are not working both alone and in collaboration with the broader metro on housing policy, right? For a long time, we looked to the federal government to deliver subsidy for affordable housing. Now with the federal government scaling back, cities and metropolitan areas are going to have to work together to make affordable housing available to people like Heather.
John Summers, we've got enthusiasts calling in who say they're participating, and it's great. We've got skeptics like Heather who said, not working for me. We heard President Obama at the top of this hour say, innovation is what this country is all about. Do you not agree, John?
Do I agree with a political cliche?
Put it however you want. It's the President of the United States saying innovation is what this country is all about.
Right. Well, clearly it's a sort of, you know, late game desperation attempt to please the business class, which is pretty much what all of this is about.
Is not dawn coming up on a new 21st century economy?
Tell me what we are getting from this. What are the new products exactly?
Look at all the apps on your cell phone.
Can you name a big significant...
Look at the lightweight metals that the president's talking
when
about.
Across the street, I see, you know, a 50-year-old subway system. And apart from information science and certain medical technologies, where is the innovation actually? What actually have we gotten from all of our investment and all of the hype? I haven't heard any real concrete proposals.
Ladies and gentlemen, you may hear the outlines of a debate that will go on for a long time in this century today. We'll stay with it. There's more on innovation right now we haven't even come to, but such is the clock. John Summers, editor-in-chief of The Baffler, thanks for coming in today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Dennis Lauer in St. Louis. Thank you so much, Dennis, and good luck there.
My pleasure. Thanks.
Bruce Katz, co-author of The Rise of Innovation Districts. Thank you, Bruce. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're welcome. This is On Point.